Hey everyone, welcome to the forum where science comes to socialize. I'm Cleo.
I'm Aubrey.
And I'm Daniela. Thanks for joining us here at the Institute on Science for Global Policies podcast. Today, we've got quite the hot button subject to discuss with you. But first, let's remind you about how you can connect with us on social media, because we really want you to connect with us on social media.
You can find us on Twitter at ISGP Forum and on Facebook by searching for ISGP's The Forum.
We've got all our episodes available on SoundCloud and iTunes, so feel free to check those out. You know, they're oldies but goodies.
But do be kind to us. It's pretty apparent in some of the early ones that we were still learning how to podcast. Plus, I'm not a co-host until, what, episode 20, I think?
Yeah, at least we totally have the podcasting thing figured out now.
I mean, I'd hope so. We're on, what, episode 48? Well, I guess as three grad students and pro-status ISGP senior fellows, we pull it together pretty well.
True, true. Okay, well, away from the self-sabotage slash weird self-compliments and whatever, and onto this episode. Today we'll be talking about none other than the anti-vaccine phenomenon that seems to be sweeping the nation, or, well, at least most of the Western world.
And we'll also be covering the importance and efficacy of vaccines and how this movement against such a successful technology within modern medicine has fallen out of the public's favor.
Our information today is coming in part from a paper written by Dr. David Markovitz titled Vaccines, Very Successful, Strangely Controversial. Dr. Markovitz is a professor of internal medicine at the University of Michigan, and he presented his paper at the 2011 ISGP conference, Emerging and Persistent Infectious Diseases, Focus on Prevention, held in San Diego, California.
So, first off, let's just state plainly that vaccines have been remarkably effective tools for saving lives worldwide when it comes to infectious disease. And while we absolutely don't want to alienate those who still have some questions or reservations, there's really no way to avoid the fact that vaccines have proven to be incredibly successful.
Right. Vaccines save millions of lives every year, and they prevent disabling effects of infectious diseases. Fun fact, it's been noted that the great vaccinologist, Dr. Maurice Hilleman, who died in 2005, likely saved more human lives than any other scientist in the 20th century.
And another fun fact, the WHO, aka the World Health Organization, estimates that immunization currently averts 2.5 million deaths every year in all age groups from diseases that once crippled and killed millions. These are diseases like diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, and measles.
And if you need another impressive example, let's just take smallpox and its global elimination into consideration.
Yes, let's. Because while we may take the eradication of disease for granted these days, this is truly no small feat, people. Smallpox killed somewhere between 300 and 500 million people, and it had the potential to continue being extremely deadly if it weren't for both the creation and widespread use of its vaccine.
Recently, immunization efforts have also reduced the rates of diarrheal disease and childhood meningitis. Some vaccines even protect against cancers caused by certain infectious diseases.
Yeah, like hepatitis B vaccine that prevented liver failure and liver cancer, which actually became the very first quote-unquote anti-cancer vaccine.
Okay, so I think we've made it clear that vaccines are effective and save tons of lives. But despite all this, the WHO estimates that 1.7 million children will die annually from vaccine-preventable diseases. That makes me sad, and I don't even like kids that much.
And 1.7 million is about the entire population of the state of Idaho, just by the way.
And despite all of the obvious successes of vaccination, when you Google vaccines, the second option to come up in the search bar is vaccines cause autism. So how did we get here? How do we go from clear, scientifically gathered numbers proving millions of lives saved to 1.7 million children still dying, and the public, or at least the part of the public who uses Google, perpetuating myths about vaccine usage?
Well, it turns out there are quite a few significant obstacles in our way. From a policy perspective, at least, vaccines can be viewed as victims of their own success. As the prevalence of a disease controlled by a vaccine diminishes, political interest in the disease really wanes, and the public ends up developing a skewed view of the risk-benefit profile.
We go into this a little bit in episode 42 if you want to hear more, but basically this means that the better a vaccine works, the less we see the disease pop up in society, the less of a concern it becomes for the average person, and therefore the less important it seems to get vaccinated for said disease. But emphasis on seems here.
And subsequently, decreased public and political interest in existing vaccines can narrow the market for a particular vaccine, which can reduce manufacturer interest in producing it. When this occurs, supplies often diminish, access may be negatively impacted, and support and funding for research into new vaccines is frequently impaired.
We have to remember throughout this conversation that this, of course, is not to say that social and economic barriers don't hinder the maximum use of effective vaccines in both poor and wealthy countries. This particular conversation and ISGP debate, however, was much more focused on the idea of available vaccines purposely not being used in the Western world, which, by the way, is extremely fascinating and dumbfounding. So today we're going to dig a little further into the hows and whys of this phenomenon playing out in more affluent countries like the US.
Okay, so the anti-vaccine movement has largely and paradoxically been led by people who are well-connected, like celebrities, and or the well-educated, which is not often where your average anti-science movements begin.
It seems that the roots of this campaign can be tracked back to a 1998 article published in the UK medical journal Lancet by Dr. Andrew Wakefield. This paper put forward a link between the measles, mumps, and rubella, or MMR vaccine, and, you guessed it, autism.
But this paper has since been retracted due to flawed scientific methods and financial conflicts of interest. And coming from someone within the scientific community, this is huge and career-threatening for the publishing scientists. Retraction is major. However, despite these vaccine and autism fears being totally unfounded, once word got out, it became pretty difficult to stop the internet floodgates from pouring in unsubstantiated claims and information on the dangers of vaccination.
And this stuff doesn't just live on the internet and have no real-life consequences, because keep in mind that due to concerns surrounding the safety of the MMR vaccine, parents stopped vaccinating their children, and we consequently had to start worrying about measles outbreaks again.
The debaters at this conference agreed that all of this points to a huge miscommunication, or even complete lack of proper communication, between the science community and the public, and then policymakers not doing much to help the situation.
Essentially, this disparity between the views of healthcare professionals devoted to examining the scientifically credible information and a small but vocal part of the public underscores the gap between scientific understanding and public acceptance.
And this was definitely a central point of the debate, so let's keep expanding on the idea. The debaters agreed that communicating the benefit and risk information to the public is an ongoing issue and challenge for scientific and governmental communities alike. But before we can work on this communication, scientists must first be able to validate the safety and the value of a particular vaccine.
And only after this is accomplished can we then start working on effectively conveying this information to public health officials.
Wait, but is it difficult to confirm vaccine safety?
From a scientific standpoint, no, not at all. Actually, the scientific community is quite capable of this, but it's with conveying clear and informative messages to policymakers that they seem to struggle.
So scientists need to develop better communication skills. No surprises there. RE episodes 10, 24, and 30 of our podcast dedicated specifically to facets of science communication.
Yeah, for real.
Well, in order for this to see any improvement, scientific and policy groups alike that deal with infectious diseases and the use of vaccines must jointly take responsibility for fostering an environment which encourages appropriate vaccine uptake and reassures the layperson that vaccination is, in fact, the right decision.
The anti-vaccine movement is a serious barrier to the appropriate use of vaccines, and it really does require more attention than the scientific and policy communities are granting it.
And this attention could likely take the form of more effective public messaging campaigns that appropriately counter the influence of those who question vaccination value and safety. Have you guys seen the HPV vaccine commercials on TV lately? They've gotten mixed reviews, some saying they're really effective and others saying they're trying to guilt trip parents. But an undeniable outcome is that they're getting more people to at least talk about the vaccine.
I don't have cable anymore, so I haven't seen those commercials, but I totally believe you, Aubrey.
Right.
We'll Google it. No, we already talked about Google. Give it a Google, you know.
True.
Anyway, I think just starting the conversation is what's really important. But the scientific community could also naturally take the lead in carrying out the message against the anti-vaccine movement. But this, of course, takes us back to the developing better communication skills thing.
All apologies if we sound like a broken record here, but science communication is so important in this instance. I mean, it's important all the time, but especially when it comes to something like vaccines, where basically half the battle is just countering the spread of false information.
And because of this, it's absolutely critical that a realistic mechanism be found that provides formal communication training for those scientific and policy leaders who are increasingly responsible for communicating the risks and benefits of vaccines to the public.
Public understanding and confidence in the safety and efficacy of vaccines remains an essential step for increasing vaccine usage. And we could probably all benefit from a better understanding of how the government works to establish this confidence in vaccines. So, if you're a science communicator out there ready to take on this challenge, do let us know. But actually, let us know. We really need someone to do this.
According to the debaters, other people that could be useful in combating the anti-vaccine movement are celebrities or popular public figures. Just think how successful this message could be if a family like the Kardashians, who collectively have God knows how many Twitter and Instagram followers, took it upon themselves to be engaged in this process of presenting scientific information through the media, which in and of itself might be controversial, but it's an option.
Yeah, so while media like this podcast, for instance, might only reach a handful of people when compared to the average celebrity's obscene number of followers, just think what an impression it might leave if Ryan Gosling Snapchatted getting his flu shot.
I'd watch that man do just about anything, so you know, I'm on board with this idea.
We'll let him know, Dee.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Moving on. Another thing that the debaters suggested could be useful are public-private partnerships for vaccines. Not quite as interesting as celebrities, but, you know. Some actually already exist among government, academia, and the private sector, but there is consensus that these need to be strengthened. We could definitely benefit from these partnerships being enhanced through both financial and regulatory avenues. And with this comes the fostering of a culture in which all sectors view the process as a mutually beneficial collaboration.
And if we do start improving these partnerships, it most likely will have to involve the wide variety of stakeholders associated with vaccine research, development, and delivery. Government, academia, and the private sector will all have significant roles to fill.
The debaters also noted that some less traditional areas of government should be included in these partnerships. For example, there was mention of the U.S. Department of Defense, or the DOD, being involved.
Okay, you lost me there a little. The Department of Defense? Within the ISGP, I'm used to connecting the DOD with climate change, not really vaccines, so can you help me out here?
Sure thing. So since the DOD has been successful in the past with integrating the views of stakeholders from academia, government, and the private sector, the idea is that they could help with this in the vaccine endeavor, not to mention the fact that public health, i.e. pandemics, and economics are important pieces of national security.
Oh, okay, gotcha. At first, I was thinking we might be embarking on the biological warfare conversation, but I'm glad we're not getting that dark today.
No, I think we'll save that one for another day. Incentives for establishing public-private partnerships could include direct financial support through contracts and grants, tax breaks, regulatory consultations during the R&D process, first-in-line privileges, and even a guaranteed number of buy-ins.
And those are all incentives from government to industry, by the way. Incentives from government to academia could include new grant funding that targets vaccine research and associated technologies, and employment opportunities for qualified graduates trained in vaccine R&D.
But of course, there are plenty of roadblocks that get in the way of these partnerships, one of which is research and development, which is a little weird because you'd think R&D could really only be beneficial. You see, vaccine research and development is a protracted process that requires substantial investment over long periods of time. This has been a continued challenge for public-private partnerships between government and the pharmaceutical industry due to the misalignment of short-term, generally annual government budgets and the longer-term interests of industry's research efforts. Basically, governments like immediate results, but the pharmaceutical industry just doesn't work like that.
which is why the debaters emphasize that the current FDA, or Food and Drug Administration, organizational structure related to vaccine approval needs to be altered to accelerate the pace of regulatory decisions. But because regulators and manufacturers are pretty well adapted to the current sort of slow-paced process, there's probably going to be a decent amount of resistance to any significant changes.
In an effort to counter this, though, the FDA could beef up their staff by increasing funding for supplementary positions and attract talented scientific regulators.
And we can attract these oh-so-talented scientists to the FDA by improving the culture of the FDA working environment through expansion of opportunities for the FDA employees to be engaged in more creative activities. The debaters suggested we think about things like promoting grant opportunities and encouraging research and publication. You know, exciting science people stuff.
Something else that's historically been a major barrier to innovation and progress, you know, other than the apparently drab working conditions of the FDA, are the liability and litigation procedures relating to vaccine approvals. The promotion of serious tort reform was identified as a critical step to improving the approval process while protecting public rights. And just to give everyone a quick brush up in our legal systems lingo.
Yeah, thank you kindly.
Tort reform involves reducing the ability of victims to bring litigation or to reduce damages they can receive. But to be honest, we're obviously not lawyers and have an at best tenuous grip on this idea. So all of you listening out there are welcome to help us tease this one out.
Right. Thank you in advance for that. But tort reform aside, we do have to be careful here, because changing the swiftness of regulation cannot mean the lowering of any safety standards. And we've absolutely talked about this in the past when it comes to GMO regulation, but it's definitely very applicable to vaccines as well.
Right, and we also have to make sure that the public especially doesn't see this process as excessively or unduly accelerated. Back to the communication thing here.
Okay, so taking a sort of sidestep now in the discussion, something we can't remove from this conversation is how influenza fits into all of this.
So true, especially because this topic came up at numerous points in Dr. Markovitz's paper and the debate.
Not going to lie, I was kind of hoping we got to avoid talking about the flu again, considering we've covered it in episodes 4, 7, 11, 14, 16, and 42. But I guess it's kind of unavoidable in this discussion.
Cleo, we're talking about vaccines. You didn't actually think we could avoid this, did you?
Okay. Hey, I get it. That was pretty short-sighted of me, so let's move on.
All right. So anyway, influenza, which causes extensive morbidity and mortality and is a target of annual vaccination campaigns, presents a somewhat unique challenge. Because of the variable nature of the influenza virus, a new vaccine, the composition of which is determined by very well-educated guests, must be administered annually.
And before you scoff and are all, well, it's just the flu, you're in bed for a few days and then you're fine, just consider a few things. Not only is seasonal influenza a major public health concern, but we also actually have to worry about the possibility of a pandemic that would evolve from a new or re-emerging type of virus. The 1918 influenza pandemic killed approximately 20 million people. A pandemic like this would have the potential to kill many millions of people and undoubtedly overwhelm the healthcare system, despite our advanced technology nearly 100 years later.
And yes, we agree that getting your annual flu shot is annoying, but there's a chance this may get less annoying and even more effective soon. The current technology used to produce flu vaccines involves the use of eggs, thus growing the virus using a fairly antiquated system. Good news, though, modern genetic ways to generate influenza vaccines are now available. Bad news? Due to regulatory hurdles, these haven't yet been put into place in the US and are only beginning to make headway in Europe.
The FDA and its European counterpart, the European Medicines Agency, play active roles in assessing and approving the new vaccine technologies. Unfortunately, the FDA is markedly underfunded and can be bureaucratic, as we mentioned before, thus slowing progress considerably. So while these new recombinant DNA and cell culture techniques could help us to respond in a more nimble fashion to annual changes in the makeup of influenza viruses, the system hasn't quite caught up with the technology yet.
And at this point, I think everyone would agree it's pretty clear that creating a universal influenza vaccine would provide a significant opportunity to improve human health globally. The issue, though, is that we're not sure if this is a realistic request from scientists and/or regulators.
But regardless, the debaters did agree that at least the concept of a universal influenza vaccine must be evaluated in, you know, a multidisciplinary review.
Well, I think we've hit a good endpoint with this conversation, so I'm going to suggest we wrap things up here.
Fair enough. Just to reiterate some points and provide some takeaways for you all, vaccines are not dangerous. Vaccines do not give you autism. Smart people get vaccines. Go vaccinate yourself and your children.
We also talked about the importance of science communication, as well as how public-private partnerships and better regulatory efforts can benefit vaccine uptake.
But what are your thoughts on vaccines? Did you get a flu shot last year, and will you get one this year? Have you vaccinated your children? If not, what's holding you back?
Hit us up on Twitter at ISGPForum and make sure to use the hashtag ISGPForum.
You can also catch us on Facebook by searching for ISGP's The Forum.
It was great socializing with all of you and with science today. Be sure to catch us, and not the flu, because surely you got the vaccine, next time right here on The Forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.